Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
You had so many experiences that other people can only faintly dream of what that would be like to be like carrying the hopes and dreams of like, oh, like, you know, of like an entire people.
Like our obviously it's nowhere near the scale of running for president, right? But for me, I think as I reflect on my journey, it has been a complete balancing act from beginning to end, which is how do I embrace my culture, but in a way, you know, do I want to be defined by it? And that's the thing, you know what I mean? Like I'm never going to shy away from the fact that I'm Asian American, but at the same time, I also don't want to be just seen only as, yo, you know, he's an Asian rapper and that's why we need to pay attention to him. It's a balancing act. So in terms of what's going on right now, you know, I feel like there's a unity within the community that I've never seen, right? And as far as everybody galvanizing their energies collectively to tell our stories, to have a voice. So I'm excited in that, you know, because I think I've always looked at my journey as my journey, right? Like, oh, this is my journey. I started rapping, blah, blah, blah. But unbeknownst to me, yo, my journey has been a lot of people's journey. It's our collective journey.
Welcome back to Yang Speaks. It's your co-host, Zach Grauman. We're glad you guys are back. We've got the one and only MC Jin, the musician, the rapper. I'll never forget, MC Jin made a Yang Gang anthem when we were running for president. And I'm not gonna lie to you, we played it in the bus way more often than we should have. But they talk about his career, how he started on BET. He's an amazing guy. Please welcome MC Jin to Yang Speaks.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. It is my pleasure to welcome to the podcast musician, artist, actor, trailblazer, pioneer, charter member of the Yang Gang, the man responsible for some of the coolest shit that come out of the presidential campaign, MC Jin. Jin, welcome.
What's up? Finally. I'm here chilling with Andrew. There's no limit to what we can do. We don't have no plans, true, but we will come through and make sure that this podcast is one of the best. Now, that's no disrespect to the rest, but I know that to be here speaking with you, I am truly blessed. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. So that's how the man won 106th and Park over and over again and became this hip-hop rising star legend, urban legend back in the day. I've been so looking forward to this, Jin, and I associate you with some of the best times on the presidential trail because anytime I saw you, it was at some rally in LA or New York. You know, there's like a crowd of like hundreds or thousands, and you would go and rock it.
Yeah, great memories. You know, if nothing else for me, you know, just that's a great way to kind of segue into, man, how I discovered you, and just the organic fashion of how I got to know you and how we ultimately, like formally cross paths. I mean, everybody's Yang Gang story is different, right? But for mine, nobody was like, hey, this is the thing, you got to join it. Like it didn't, nobody had to hard sell it to me. I discovered it on my own. And I think a key part was, the book, right? The War on Normal People. And I have this, you know, kind of funny, just thing that I like an inside joke that's with inside myself is that as I discovered more about you and I would cross paths with people in the Yang Gang, they would all say, yeah, I learned about him through the Joe Rogan podcast. Have you seen the Joe Rogan podcast? And I was like, no, I haven't seen it. And it became this ongoing thing that the more people said to me, have you seen it? I was like, no, and I'm not going to watch it.
You're like, I'm going to withhold. It's funny, Jin, because we had the reverse joke on the trail during that time where like everyone who was coming was like, hey, Joe Rogan podcast.
I kind of feel like I'm part of a special breed that, yo, I hooked onto the Yang Gang without the Joe Rogan podcast, right? So shout out to everybody else that's in that same category. But nonetheless, I did hear that podcast was a great introduction to you, your vision, you know, what you know, what you're trying to bring to the table and you know, kind of overall picture of who is this Andrew Yang guy, you know? But in terms of actually meeting you, because it's one thing when I read the book, it's one thing when I'm watching you on the news clips and the interviews, but I think to be at a rally, to be able to introduce you on stage, to perform, you know, Drew Yang Gang, that's who I hooked up with, Drew Yang. And as soon as it clicked, I was like, yo, nobody's done this? Well, here I am, right? And that's when I found my purpose in life.
Are you kidding, man? I mean, you've had your purpose, and I really want to get into this because you are such a pioneer for so many people. And I'm just imagining being an Asian American kid growing up in the 80s and 90s. In your case, you were born in Florida, but then you all moved to New York and Queens when you were a teenager. Is that right?
Yeah, I moved to New York. It's about to be 20 years. No, this year is 20 years. I moved to New York when I was 19. And there's an interesting tie. You know, it's kind of like a, what do you call it? Like a bittersweet reason, because it was directly after 9/11. So 9/11 happened and that triggered a massive change globally, right? But as it pertains to my own household, we were living in Miami at the time. I was born and raised in Miami. Shout out to all the Miami Yang Gang out there, right? All the Florida Yang Gang. But at the time, I remember the discussion in our household was we wanted to be closer to my mama and yeah. So that's grandma and grandpa on the paternal side. So they came to America, you know, they're of the 60s, 70s generation. So when they immigrated to America, it was straight to New York, straight to the heart of Chinatown, literally a hop, skip, and a jump away from the World Trade. So what happened was after 9/11, as my mom and dad were discussing how do we be closer to them, rather than uprooting them and bringing them to Miami, the discussion was we go up to New York. Now, at the time, I had graduated high school, so I was like 18, turning 19, roughly. And, you know, they actually said to me, you don't have to come. You know, I mean, you're old enough now that you can decide, do you want to stay down here or do you want to go? It was a no-brainer for me, though, because I've always been like a homebody. You know, I'm very much attached to my family.
Sure, yeah.
And also, I knew that if I was going to make this rap dream come to life in any way, it would be at the Mecca. It would be in New York City, the birthplace of hip hop. You know,
so you grow up in Miami. You clearly are super into hip hop from an early age.
Yes.
And then I'd imagine because your grandparents were in New York, you probably traveled to New York periodically and visited them. Is that right?
Often, every summer. Every summer, from a young age, but most vividly in my mind, probably from 8 years old on to 13. So like those 5 years, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, every summer I'm in New York, I'm running around Chinatown, you know, Columbus Park, I'm all over like East Broadway, a lot of trips back and forth down East Broadway, mainly because that was the route from the apartments that my grandparents lived in to the heart of Chinatown. So yeah, a lot of vivid, fond childhood memories, walking up and down Mott Street, Mulberry, like a lot of memories, really, really dope.
So you're into music, and it sounds like even as a teenager, you're like, yo, I think I want to do this like myself professionally. I have to imagine that your parents were not thrilled with this passion in their son, because, you know, I know a little something about Asian parents.
All right. So on that side of things, yes, there were several, you know, end of the world, Armageddon level type, you know, just tensions within our household surrounding this particular passion of mine. I think at its peak was probably as I got older. Because when I was like 12 or 13, it was very clear that I had an affinity for this. Because here are some like key points that I remember. I remember that when I was 12 or 13, one thing that was a crucial spark was we went to this carnival in Miami. And at the carnival, there was like a booth where you, like a mobile recording booth. And they still have these now, where you basically pay like $20 or whatever. They'll put you into the recording booth. They'll give you the lyrics to a particular song that you pick. And then you can record it. And, you know, they'll give you a cassette recording of it. So I remember I did this. And it was an A side, B side. On the A side, I did LL Cool J. Mama said, knock you out. I'm gonna knock you out. And then on the B side, I did Crisscross, jump, jump, the Mac Daddy make you jump, jump. Some of them try to rhyme, but they can't rhyme like me, right? So the point I'm trying to make is, as a 12, 13-year-old, I don't think I could have facilitated this myself. So to some degree, my mom or dad, they had to have paid the $20, agreed to this, and let me do it. So I did that. And I guess at that point, they didn't realize that this was the beginning of something that would alter the rest of the course of my life. So I think the real tension didn't kick in until I was maybe like 16, 17. Because at 16, 17, I was very vocal to them about the fact that this is my path, you know? And number one, I think especially approaching senior year, I was very straightforward about, I don't intend on applying to any colleges. And honestly,
no, that's a tough nut to...
For parents in general, but in this case, yes, I think telling your immigrant Asian parents that, you know, I'm not even taking the SATs. Like if anyone even asked me, yeah, what was your SAT scores, Jin? Non-existent. I didn't take it.
You know, I love the purity of this, Jin, because, you know, that this is like, hey, there is no other path. Like I'm not going to like check it out and see what that other path would look like. It's like, this is what I'm doing.
there's a beauty to it, because as I got older, eventually, you know, they came around. And I think it was, you know, in terms of them coming around, it was a combination of just, you know, at some point they had to realize that, well, you know, it's not that we love our son any less, but it's just like, this is his calling. This is his passion, you know? And even though initially they weren't 100% on board, they did arrive at a place where they accepted it. My mom came around really quick. My mom was like, okay, if this is something that he really wants to do, you know, she was on board for it. My dad though, his name is Joe. He definitely was like, I'm holding out as long as I can. Right. And he was not for, but the quote unquote happy ending is that as far as right now, oh my gosh, my dad is probably, he's probably more hip hop. He's more of a hip hop head than I am. Right? Like he's like, it's amazing. It's amazing.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
Did you perform two live audiences, for example, in like your high school talent show? Was there some evidence that you actually had not just passions, but also, like, frankly, ability?
Well, I'll tell you this. I'll be the first to tell you. Like 14-year-old Jin, you know, it was one thing to mimic and emulate the rappers that I loved, right? In this case, yeah. Whether it's LL Cool J, whether it's Chris Cross, whether it's whoever, right? But to actually, you're right. What does it mean in terms of my own craft? Like, are you writing your own raps, Jin? Are you performing at the talent show? Yes. So to answer your question, yes. So there were several talent show experiences. I definitely started working on my own compositions, and I will be the first to say, they were garbage. They were hot trash. But everybody starts somewhere. But I have fond memories of that too, of that process. Because aside from the parents, right? So you cover the Asian parent side. But another fascinating aspect to me is one reason why I loved hip hop so much, because there was a camaraderie to it. So my close circle of friends, right? Like my, let's say, close 3-4 friends. That was like our clique. That was our little squad. We were all into the same things naturally. The NBA, we all love playing ball. And in this case, hip hop, right? Like we just loved hip hop. And the funny thing is, these are some of my best, like BFFs, so to speak, friends that I still keep in touch with to this day. And I'm grateful for that too. You know, we're all about to be close to 40, right? But I remember vividly that even within this small circle of friends, these are my brothers, my comrades, they're like, "Yo, Jin, ain't nobody trying to hear you rap, yo. Nobody, nobody."
They were like, "You can do it."
No. These were not those friends.
Really, the big question is like, how the heck does someone break into the music industry, as like a 19-year-old kid? Like you show up in Queens. Like, what the heck was that process like? Because for me, and I remember when you did start winning these rap battles on BET.
On 106 and Park, yeah.
Yeah, 106 and Park. I think that was probably a couple years after you arrived in New York, but that was when you started hitting the radar of popular culture and people like me.
I mean, I feel like all along, I was looking for this big break. So in Miami, I was already like, as mentioned before, probably a definitive moment was graduating high school. So, okay, yes. I don't have SAT scores to share, but I do have a graduation diploma. A pivotal moment was after graduating, I kind of already was full steam ahead. So this is in Miami. I'm doing demo tapes. I'm trying to get into every single battle competition that I can. I'm trying to get into every talent showcase that I can. And I'm literally running around the streets of Miami, just battling, like just freestyle battling any and everywhere, at the mall, at the movie theater, at the arcade, everywhere. So I think the thing is, when I made the move to New York, I was in the same mindset, but just now it's a whole new playground for me. So I'm running around Times Square battling, like just like, who raps? I'll battle anywhere. In the Village, there used to be a record store, iconic, called Fat Beats, the corner of 6th and 8th, where there used to be a Grace Papaya. The Grace Papaya isn't even there anymore. But there was a record store called Fat Beats, and I used to stand in front of the Fat Beats record store, both freestyle battling and basically selling mixtapes, like mix CDs.
Wow,
and just be like, hustle, I was that guy. I was that guy. I was the, hey, yo, you listen to hip hop? Yo, check this out. Check this out, man. I was that guy. So this is kind of the year or so leading into the 106 in Park.
To get on 106 in Park, you probably have to try out or something.
Yeah, I went to and I'm super like I have a strong, vivid memory, and it's something that I hold dear to my heart is the fact that I went to just a traditional, conventional open casting call along with the other, you know, 300, you know, hopefuls, right? The other roughly 200, 300 people that had the same vision as me, like, yo, I'm going to get on this stage and this is going to be my big break. So I think that's the thing is like, I had always been looking for the big break. And in this case, the 106 in Park, it was the big break, you know?
So for those of you listening who don't know what we're referring to, there was a show on BET called 106th in Park that would just have rap battles.
Yes.
And you'd have a champion. The champion would come back every week.
Yeah.
And so Jin ended up setting the record for how long someone reigned.
7 weeks. Well, there was one guy. I always like to – I'm the guy that's always very adamant about giving proper credit to for me. There was one guy before me that actually – he did the seven – they call it the seven-week run, right? And after 7 weeks, there's this notion of like, all right, this guy – he's already proven himself. So we're putting him in the Hall of Fame. So there was a guy before me, his name is Poster Boy. So I always like to acknowledge him because he ran so that I could fly. Right. So shout out to Poster Boy.
It's so fun. So after you win 7 weeks in a row, they put you in the Hall of Fame. I mean, that's pretty dope. So you get up there, you start winning. I'm going to guess that of those 200 to 300 people, you were probably the only Asian American.
Ding, 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 ding. Yo, you clearly did the math. Yes, I will attest, unless someone were to come out other way, because I clearly do not. I would have remembered if I was there at that.
You would have noticed like the other Asian American.
I would have noticed another Asian dude there if I was. Like if I remember on that day of auditioning, you know, you show up and you look around and it's just a sea of rappers, you know, from Queens, from Brooklyn, from Manhattan, the Bronx, Staten Island, just everywhere. Some even from out of town, actually, because everyone's just vying for a spot on this stage to showcase themselves. But yeah, I think I would have remembered if I saw another Asian person.
You would have remembered, man, because, you know.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/RS10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/RS10 today.
So you win 7 weeks in a row, and then shortly thereafter, you become signed to Rough Riders, which is like a major, major rap label. So was that directly off of 106th and Park?
Yeah. So there's like a fairy tale-esque aspect to all of this, because Rough Riders, as it stands, was one of my childhood like dream labels to be on. Right. Like I think as a 16, 17, 18 year old, your dream is like, okay, how do I sign with Dr. Dre? How do I sign with, you know, the Neptunes? Or how do I sign with Rockefeller, Rough Riders? Like I'm from that era, right? Like you mentioned, I was born in the 80s, grew up in the 90s. So at the peak of my you know, like hip hop journey up to that point, these were the end game was to either, yo, Rockefeller, Rough Riders, wherever the door opens. So in terms of Rough Riders, they actually reached out before I won 7 weeks. So I think maybe a little bit past the halfway mark, after I had won 3 or 4 weeks, they already reached out. We were already having conversations, and they were so committed and they believed in my journey so much that they said, hey, if we can close this deal out even before you win the 7 weeks,
you can announce it.
Yes. Yes. They said after you win it, they kind of spoke it into existence. They're like, after you win on the 7th week, right there is when you will announce that you've signed with Rough Riders. And this is all, and I'm so grateful because this is essentially all documented and it's captured and it lives forever on film, right? So I win the battle and the host, Free and AJ, they're like, yeah, Jin, so man, congratulations. You know, how do you feel right now? And I'm like, how do I feel? Well, I've signed with Rough Riders. And there's this iconic moment that I forgot about. And recently someone brought it back up to me on Clubhouse. They were like, Jin, I'll never forget after you won the 7th week, you announced that you signed with Rough Riders and you went in your sweater and you pulled out the Rough Rider chain and you like put it in your mouth and you bit on it. And I'm like, damn, I don't even remember that. But apparently to this eighth grader, right? He was probably in the 8th or 9th grade at the time. He was like, yo, I'll never forget that. But the beauty of this is it would be one thing if it was like an Asian kid, right? Because I encounter a lot of that, like Asian, let's say male and females, right? That are in their 30s now. So at the time, they might have been like a junior high or a high school kid. And they'll tell me the story of, man, I used to be, you know, running home on Friday to watch it, just to see someone that remotely looked like me. So those tales, I'm always grateful and I cherish. But this particular story about the you pulled your chain out and you put it in your mouth, it was a African-American guy, right? That was like, yo, I was in the 8th grade. And for some reason, Jin, that moment has sat with me for like 20 years now. Just when you pulled the chain out and you put it in your mouth and you were like, yeah, I'm Rough Riders now. And I'm just like, that's the power of, you know, like of cultural connection. You know what I mean? Here you have a Chinese kid on Black entertainment television with a young Black kid watching it, but everyone's just like, you know, just connected. And there isn't, you know, necessarily like a feeling of like, yo, this doesn't make sense. It made sense to me on stage. It made sense to this 8th grader as he's watching it. So I don't know, like I cherish that. I cherish that.
Yeah, it's a very universal, like underdog story, honestly. It's like, you know, seeing this person come up and then have them be signed by one of the major record labels. It's like made for Hollywood stuff, man. I mean, I remember, frankly, like hearing like, hey, there was this Asian guy who won 7 weeks, like was like joined the this, and then he got signed. Right, I was like, oh, that's dope. I have some friends who are Asian American creatives, and a lot of them have to at some point make a choice as to whether they're going to try to build their careers in Asia or the U.S.
Yes.
And so in your case, after a number of years performing and releasing a number of albums here in the U.S., you got drawn to Asia. And I'm wondering about how that happened. It sounds like you had like one or two events out there. And then did you discover when you were out there, you were like, hey, you know, like maybe I should like spend some more time here. Because I'd imagine out there, well, I'm not sure if your reputation preceded you when you got there or whether like there were like fans, you know, whether there were hip hop fans. I think you're one of the figures that actually helped popularize hip hop in Asia. Is that right?
I underestimated the impact of that, or maybe not underestimated, but I was oblivious to it. You know, I mean, I knew, but I didn't know until later on. So to circle back a bit, yes, a defining moment for me in terms of my overall journey leading up to right now is actually when I parted ways with Rough Riders. So I think that's a good place to start at. So literally, I signed with them in 2002, coming off the 106 in Park. We go full throttle, right? We start working on my album. My album comes out in 2004. So my first official debut as a rap artist is this Rough Riders released album called The Rest Is History. So that came out in 2004. And I got to be honest, like even just the release of that album and everything following that, it took me some time to process the highs and lows of that. Because I think, number one, there was just this excitement that I think nobody had ever seen before. And it did kind of surround the fact that, yo, this is the Chinese dude that was on BET. He's with Rough Riders now. And then there's this sense of like, this is something we've never seen before. So theoretically, this should be gigantic, right? Something as simple as just the notion of there's like billions of Chinese people. Even if one out of every five of them buy his album, this is going to be phenomenal.
That's like 200 million sales. Yeah, totally.
Exactly. So that was I got to be honest, it both worked for me, but against me. It worked for me because it created this sense of like, yo, this is going to be amazing. Not to mention he is on Rough Riders, one of the hugest labels ever, right? So I think it worked for me in the sense of creating excitement, but it kind of worked against me because it set this expectation that, to be honest, was somewhat unrealistic, I guess, right? And everything I'm saying now is in hindsight. You know, I'm saying it in hindsight. But what happened was when the album released, for lack of better words, it definitely didn't hit nowhere near that mark that everyone had set for it to be deemed a success. And what does that mean? You know, the platinum plaques, the accolades, right? The Grammy Award, the MTV Award. So none of that stuff was attained. So in that sense, there was this feeling of like, did Jin really live up to his potential, right? So I think upon me parting ways with Rough Riders, even though it was a amicable split, right? Like I literally sat down with the CEOs of the label one day and there was a mutual agreement that, hey, we gave it a go, but we both feel like this might be where we part ways. So we parted ways in that fashion. But to the general public, that's not exciting enough. So to the general public, the more enticing story is, yo, did you hear that Jin got dropped from Rough Riders? So that just became the Jin got dropped from Rough Riders? Jin got dropped? So then for me, I had to spend a substantial amount of time processing that. Because of course, the rapper in me, the young man in me, I was very defensive, right? So I was very like, yo, man, the industry is rigged and, you know, everything is smoke and mirrors. My frustration was not at Rough Riders, the label, but my frustration was with like just the system. And that was a defense mechanism, to be honest. So I'm just like, even through the music I was releasing at the time, it was very bitter, frustrated, anti-industry, anti-establishment. I'm like, yo, I'm a real MC. I'm a real MC, right? So in hindsight, I'm glad I had that. It was therapeutic. But underneath, man, I was broken. And underneath, like meaning there was this sense of like, man, I watched my childhood dream come true. And then I kind of watched it fall apart too. So this is, I preface the Asia thing with that because I think it's connected. So as I'm navigating through this heaviness, there was like a good 2-year period where I'm like, I was this close to basically saying, this might not be it. Let me go to Home Depot. Let me go to, I don't know why I always say Home Depot because not that I specifically, maybe I have a subconscious interest in working at Home Depot.
Yeah,
home
improvement, like yeah.
But I always, when I share this story, I'm like, I was this close to going to Home Depot and seeing if I could get a job application, right? Because I'm like, yo, I mean, if this is not the path for me, I'm not going to just wallow and just be unproductive. I still got to go out there and get a job. Now, at that time, I wasn't even married yet. So I wasn't married. I didn't have a family. So the intensity of responsibility wasn't extremely heavy. But here comes the opportunity to go to Asia. Specifically at the time, I started dabbling and rapping in Cantonese, which is, the language we spoke at home growing up. So I'm grateful on that note too. But I started dabbling, rapping in Cantonese. And then in 2008, I had a chance to go and release an album in Cantonese in Hong Kong. And then one door opened to two doors opened to four into eight. And I spent like a good 4 years there, branching out into stuff beyond music. So acting, hosting, things like that. And then the shift to come back was actually when my first son was born, Chance.
That'll do,
so we have an 8-year-old. Yeah, we have an 8-year-old. We have an 8-year-old and a 1-year-old now at this point.
Congratulations, man! I've got an 8-year-old too, and that child being born definitely does change things up.
You hear that? Your dog knows spring is coming sooner than you think. Dog walks, dog parks, playing fetch, all the stuff your dog loves to do with you. But the warmer weather also means that fleas and ticks are coming back. Fleas and ticks are in the grass, in the woods, and even on their dog friends. Fleas are an itchy nuisance, can easily get into your home, furniture, and beds, which can be terrible. Ticks are even worse. They're hard to spot, but can carry disease and get your dog really sick. PetMeds has your furry friend protected with the best products to prevent flea and ticks all year long. PetMeds pharmacists connect directly with your vet to save you time and deliver the best products for your pet. PetMeds offers low prices on all flea and tick meds, including NexGard, Simparica, and more. And PetMeds AutoShip helps you save even more with additional discounts on regular shipments of PetMeds, dog food, and other high-quality supplies. So get ready for all the spring fun now. Visit PetMeds.com and use promo code PODCAST to save 40% on your first auto ship order. That's PetMeds.com and promo code PODCAST.
So did you meet your wife while you were in Asia?
So my wife is an ABC, like myself, American-born Chinese. So there's a strong parallel in terms of our journey in that sense. Her family came here from Hong Kong. She was born and raised. She's a true native native New Yorker to the heart. So she was born in New York, raised in New York. She's here. She's a New Yorker to the heart. She's probably, you know, next to Spike Lee, she's right there in terms of Knicks, supporting the Knicks. she's that. I met her, of all places, in Puerto Rico. So I met her in Puerto Rico, and it was in the context of a hip-hop related music seminar. So I was there to perform, and she was there as part of the organizers. And it's funny because I remember when I showed up, I walk up to the registration counter, you know, where you get your badge and the itinerary and stuff like that. And I looked at her and she looked at me. And I think our mutual kind of thought was, we're probably the only Chinese people here, right?
At this thing. At this hip hop performance.
At this hip hop. Yeah. But, it wasn't like sparks flying and, you know, it wasn't like that, but we ended up crossing paths again later on in New York. And then it was just like, what do you call it? A traditional courtship. Hey, you want to go watch a movie? And after the movie, it's, hey, you want to go get something to eat? You know? So I think we watched like a movie almost like twice a week for that period. And, you know, it was dinner, movie. And honestly, when I went to Asia for that first run to do the Cantonese album, we were not, we were definitely not married yet. So there were no kids. We weren't even engaged. I think it was actually after me spending like a year or two in Hong Kong that I was like, what are you doing, Jin? You know what I mean? Like, there she is.
Oh, wow.
She's right in front of you.
Another,
you know?
Hollywood thing, man. You
Another
were like, oh,
Hollywood
I'm going to go
thing.
Back, go back and go back for my girl, like, and
yes.
Eventually my wife.
Yes, yes.
So how was the time in Asia? I mean, it must have been an adventure. Like you know, I think you did something with like Wang Leehom, who I actually kind of grew up with. Like, he and I
yes.
went to summer camp together and
what?
And then, yeah, no really, I know, it's a small world. And so for him, he like, you know, went to Asia to try and make the music thing work, and it worked out. What was it like working in the industry in Asia versus in the States?
Yeah, so man, Leehom's amazing, by the way, super talented. And you know, kudos to him actually, because he was one of the first people to reach out to me. And specifically, you know, kind of to extend the invite to work on music together. He literally was the first. So in terms of post 106 in Park, post Rough Riders, he was the first artist in that aspect from Asia, you know, who had a huge following and already fully established, to reach out to this, you know, little rapping Chinese kid in New York and say, hey, I'm working on my next album and I have a song that I totally can hear you on and would love to invite you on. And it wouldn't even feel complete if you didn't jump on it. So he was very inviting in that regard. So shout out to him. But the experience for me, for sure, was culture shock, you know, because I think I had been to Hong Kong several times as a kid, several times. So in the same fashion that I had a grandma and grandpa in New York, I also had I had grandparents in Hong Kong. So as a child, I would frequent, you know, vacation trips to Hong Kong. So it wasn't like a complete fish out of water sense, but But I think the context of what brought me out there was crucial, because now I'm there as a recording artist. And now there is this notion of, every time I would do a radio interview or a press interview, I would be introduced as, you know, straight from America, the rapping sensation, you know, and, you know, there's this pre-built perception of who I am already, a preconception of who I am already, which is, you know, he's born and raised in America, or as they would call us there, I love the title, ABCs, right? And what that means is, even right off the bat, I think not all, but for the most part, there is a notion of, okay, he might not be as Chinese as us. He might not be as in touch with his culture. So when I'm doing these interviews, something as trivial as, let's say it's a food interview, right? And we're sitting at a restaurant, you'll hear the little jab that's like, hey, you need a fork? You probably don't know how to use chopsticks. You need a fork. Hey, somebody get him a fork, right? Or just things like that, you know? And I took it in stride. Like a lot of it, I don't think it was malicious, but you know, every now and then you'll be like, yo, like, is that, you know, like, where is this? You know? And some of them were really nice about it, but I think for some cases, there was definitely like, I had to process it and not take it personal.
You never feel more American than when you're in Asia.
Because they
go after you. And like that same thing happened to me, you know, here in the States, you're like, well, you know, you're Asian American and whatnot. You go over there and they're like, hey, ABC, ABC. It's like,
All in all though, once I was able to get past the culture shock, even for me, it was great. It was amazing. Like I said, it was beyond what I expected in terms of productivity, in terms of fruitfulness. And more importantly, man, just me being able to come into manhood. I would even say that, like, come into a space where I'm like, I'm very clear on what my purpose is, on what my passion is, what my priorities are. So it was great. And honestly, even in Hong Kong specifically, is where I grew in my faith, like in a way that completely caught me off guard. Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful, man. And you come back, you become a dad, a family man, raising the kids in New York. You know, you've branched out creatively. You're working on a bunch of different things. You're in one of the Fast and Furious movies. You did a comedy special that was released online.
Yeah.
And so I love the fact that you're still expanding artistically and creatively. And you remain one of like the true trailblazers, certainly. For a lot of people, what are you working on now, and what can people expect to see from you?
So I think it's a very special time, you know, for myself and for our community, right? And I emphasize our community. I mean, like, as far as within the Asian American community, and I only say that because in terms of like trailblazing, right? You know, and I'm very humbled whenever I hear you say it, because I don't know, I just feel like sometimes the beauty in being a trailblazer in that sense is when you're not necessarily setting out to do it. Does that make sense?
Oh no, I get it, man. I mean, like
I ran
for president,
exactly.
And like it's like you're like, well, you know, I'm very, very aware of the fact that I'm the first
Asian American. Bingo. But I think the driving force is you're balancing that combined with what just your core vision is, right?
Yeah.
So it's like
totally.
you it is a balancing act. Because even for me, obviously, it's nowhere near the scale of running for president, right? But for me, I think as I reflect on my journey, it has been a complete balancing act from beginning to end, which is how do I embrace my culture, but in a way, you know, do I want to be defined by it? And that's the thing, you know what I mean? Like, I'm never going to shy away from the fact that I'm Asian American. But at the same time, I also don't want to be just seen only as, yo, you know, he's an Asian rapper, and that's why we need to pay attention to him. It's a balancing act, you know? But I've learned to find peace in, you know, just internally. So in terms of what's going on right now, you know, I feel like there's a unity within the community that I've never seen, right? And as far as everybody galvanizing their energies collectively to tell our stories, to have a voice. So I'm excited in that, you know, because when I think of trailblazers, for some reason, the first person to pop into my head is Clyde Drexler. So, but I think, you know, to me, there's a beauty in, this is a real real-time epiphany that I've had literally within these last few weeks. I think I've always looked at my journey as my journey, right? Like, oh, this is my journey. I started rapping, blah, blah, blah. But unbeknownst to me, yo, my journey has been a lot of people's journey, you know, like meaning when I encounter these, you know, 30-year-olds now and they're like, no, Jin, I remember being, you know, in the seventh grade, as I mentioned earlier. So it's dawning on me more and more now that it's our collective journey. So I think I'm still in the music zone. I think music will always be at the core of me. But in terms of like the acting, I feel like I'm only slowly tapping into the acting thing. So hopefully there's more opportunities in that regard, developing projects on my own as well. And just pushing forward, you know, pushing forward my own journey and our collective journey, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, you've been a real leader around the anti-Asian violence that's been occurring. You know, you in at least one case helped galvanize energy around like a victim of hate crime here in New York. And then you helped draw a lot of attention to helping that person.
Yeah,
it's been a really difficult time. But I have to say, Jin, like your journey is not your own. You've inspired so many people. And I'm grateful that you and I have become friends over this time. I'm incredibly grateful to you. You've elevated the last couple of years for me, truly. And having you alongside me at some of these events has made me so happy. It's like filled me with joy. You're just like a very uplifting person. And I think, you know, this conversation actually helps explain like the journey you went through, because like you had so many experiences that other people can like, you know, like can only faintly dream of what that would be like to be like carrying like the mantle of, in some cases, you know, an entire like multi-million, like the hopes and dreams of like, oh, like, you know, of like an entire people, like are artistically, and then you know, going through the ups and downs of that, and then having to face down what that would be like. Most of us can't really imagine what that would be like. And one thing that I said at the last event we were at is that we need to support creators more, because there's something very, very deeply personal about you're trying to create art and then put it out there. You know, we need more of it in the world. We need more folks like you in doing the things that you do, for sure. And it's one reason I was excited to have this conversation, so people could kind of, frankly, like humanize the journey that you've undergone.
Thank you for having me, man. I'm excited for what's to come for you. Super excited. Excited to be part of it. Excited to collectively just push forward, man. Definitely.
Fantastic, Jin. Let's do it, man. Let's show that there's no limit. People can do anything.
Anything.
Just like you told your parents, like, you know, decades ago. It's like, don't worry, mom and dad. Like, we can do this thing.
Yes.